wasn't right for you. It wasn't hard to believe, 'cause when I watched TV, I would never see a leading lady look like me. Familiar package with less pigment, I nicked it, it's just reality.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
All right, you are listening to Off the Hour, in particular. This is the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. I'm your host, Jules Bichel, and all for the next hour, I'm going to be sharing some of the work I've been doing at the station with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Now, we're starting things off today with a look at the Trans Patient Union at McGill, which advocates for better trans healthcare and provides resources to Montrealers seeking gender-affirming care. Later on the show, you'll hear about a contentious decision from McGill to end the floor fellow position, leaving the future of Res Life up in the air. And lastly, I'll be talking to some of the McGill students currently on hunger strike in protest of the university's ongoing ties to Israel. And that is what we've got on the show today. It's a pretty McGill-focused episode, I know, but we're going to start off with something that has some broader resonance with Montreal as a whole. I'm going to be talking with, Jacob Williams, who's here in the studio, discussing the Trans Patient Union in advance of their workshop this coming Monday, How to Survive Montreal Healthcare as a Trans Patient. Jacob, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, what is the Trans Patient Union?
The Trans Patient Union is a by and for trans patient group with two primary functions. The first is to help patients navigate the complicated and obscure process of obtaining gender-affirming care in Montreal. The second is to speak directly to our clinicians, to our providers, and to clinics, and try and advocate for better standards of care. So this means getting rid of discriminatory and outdated practices that are really rampant across the board when it comes to trans healthcare in Montreal and elsewhere.
Yeah, you have a workshop this coming Monday called How to Survive Montreal Healthcare as a Trans Patient, and it's, you know, interesting. It's not how to succeed, but it's really how to survive. What are the issues in gender-affirming care that make this kind of workshop, you know, not only necessary for folks, but actually a matter of survival?
Yeah, it's survive. It's a reminds us a bit of like survival guides, you know. But but that choice is also you're correct in identifying that choice for us. Navigating healthcare as a trans patient is really, really difficult. There is just, frankly, a really big shortage of resources, and anybody who's a patient in Montreal knows this, whether they're trans or not. But trans people face a lot of really particular barriers when it comes to accessing healthcare, especially when it's transition-related healthcare, but also other forms of healthcare. When we think about the issues that trans patients face, we think primarily about the fact that there are, like, so few actual like studies on the issues that matter for trans patients when it comes to their health care. There's very little research done. It is on the issues that matter primarily for our health. There are so many studies on transition regret. There is like a single study ever on the impact of, or the effectiveness and impact of bicalutamide for trans feminine patients. This is like a very popular anti-androgen medication. And like, there's one study ever, that's just one example. There's so little studies on the things that matter. And there isn't any education. It's not normal for doctors to receive any education about trans patients. To be honest, it's hard enough for them to get good education about women's health, let alone trans patients' health. And so doctors, if they do know anything about trans patients, it's usually because they've gone through quote-unquote extra means to go above and beyond to meet this niche demographic of marginalized patients, blah, blah, blah. So it's so oftentimes they have to rely on limited resources. Oftentimes they learn from other doctors who are already practicing, from a handful of guides from progressive and important organizations. But overall, it's very common for us to speak to patients who have doctors who see hundreds of trans patients, and those doctors have huge gaps in their practices. They are using outdated methods. They're using obviously discriminatory methods in their practicing, and there's no way for these patients to know this going in, and there's really nobody holding these doctors and providers accountable for how they're providing care.
Yeah, can you just give me an example? Like, if I were trying to find a doctor who could give me hormone replacement therapy or something like that, I'm sure there would be challenges. But you're saying, you know, even if I were to find a doctor who, you know, through a network like yours, maybe I would know that they had been seeing trans patients, like I could still encounter discriminatory practices or other barriers to receiving proper care. What does that look like? You know, what are you hearing from people?
The reality is, and we know this from speaking to patients in our experience, the only way you can really know what's going on in a clinic and in a provider's office is by speaking to many of their patients. Doctors have basically what they call, sometimes referred to as personal discretion. So if a doctor decides that they want to hold their practice a certain way when it comes to certain critical choices, they can basically just choose to do so. So if a doctor says, I want you to do a full psychiatric assessment before I will refer you for HRT, something that would be completely ludicrous to ask, they can just sort of make you do that. And by that, I mean, they will not provide you hormones until you've done that to their satisfaction. If they decide that they want to do a huge number of a huge number of appointments, that's way more than is necessary, you just kind of have to do that. And you probably can't pick another doctor because there are so few available. You probably waited for months just to see this one doctor. So if they're going to have these practices, there's a good chance that you're either going to have to like put up with it or consider whether or not you want to pay private or consider DIY options for your hormones.
Yeah, I mean, we all know, right? It's hard enough seeing a doctor in this province. So what you're saying definitely resonates, right? Just in terms of the additional barriers that I can imagine trans patients would face. But you guys are a trans patient union. How does that kind of patient union model work in terms of addressing these barriers to care and actually pushing for change here?
When we think of unionization, we often think of labor force, rightfully so. For us, it's primarily about public pressure, but also addressing our providers directly. Primarily what we do as the union part of what we do is that we try and contact our providers directly and basically get them to provide better standards of care. So it might mean something like getting connected through clinics or through communities to meet with a doctor and be like, hey, we spoke to some of your patients. Can you tell us about like this specific practice or like why a patient told us this about your care? Are you aware that other doctors are doing this? Of course, it has to be approached rather gently, like in the actual discussion with providers. Because at the end of the day, it's up to them. If they don't want to listen to us, we can't really do anything about it very much unless there's something really, really crazy going on. But usually it means us trying to exert whatever influence we can to convince the providers and clinics to change what they're doing to the satisfaction of their patients.
Yeah, and I know that you are mostly based around McGill, right? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about changes that you've been able to affect there using this model?
It's a little bit hard for us. I want to be transparent that it is a little bit hard for us to gauge exactly what our impact is. It is our observation that doctors generally do improve their practices the longer that they practice. But there have been instances where we've pushed for specific changes and the doctor may have refused or showed some hesitancy. And then we will interview patients that immediately started receiving care after we complained. And those things are changed. There used to be things like mandatory waiting periods for patients from some of the providers at McGill, at the McGill Health Clinic. It used to be a much longer process to get the whole process done from start to finish. There used to be certain questions asked to patients during the process that we think are not appropriate. And we're very happy to see that those things have changed in like our communication with the providers there. And we strongly believe that this can be a model that other people can use to try and advocate better care at their clinics as well.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, a huge part of the work that you do, right, is just helping people in Montreal, not just in McGill, but throughout Montreal, navigate healthcare, right, and sort of find different doctors or different services. How has that been growing as well?
That's a much easier part to grow. We've worked a lot to like localize ourselves around this one clinic, and it takes a lot of time to like develop a relationship with a single clinic. But resources are much easier to produce, at least in certain critical capacities. Right now we are primarily at McGill, but we are trying to expand as much as possible to cover issues that affect all trans patients in Montreal. It's going pretty well. We have a mega list of HRT providers, which is just a compilation of all the lists made by other wonderful organizations, but they can be really tricky to find. We're currently working on a hair removal document, so something on laser and electrolysis, all of the places in Montreal that will note testimonies from patients who've been there. We can note any discriminatory experiences or good and bad experiences at these clinics. I think it's been really successful. We also have individual assistants. It's very common for patients to email us or DM us on Instagram with their very particular concerns. And we absolutely invite people to do that. Please reach out to us. We speak all the time with patients who are in very complicated situations. And I feel proud to say that I think we always leave them in a much better place than when they started.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, of course, that comes up is, you know, you guys are working to try and fill a gap. But, you know, the question is, like, why is there this gap? And one thing that comes to mind is, you know, trans healthcare has really become a political issue, especially when it comes to minors, especially in provinces like New Brunswick and Alberta. And the position of those governments is definitely in terms of limiting services. Here in Quebec, there's the new Comité des Sages that the CAC government has introduced of non-trans people and people, in fact, without any expertise on the issue, overseeing what the government's new positioning will be on questions of gender identity. How does this kind of political approach, which seems to center the concerns of non-trans individuals over, you know, the standards of care for trans and non-binary folks, you know, how does that impact just the kind of services that people are able to receive, the work that you guys are doing at the TPU?
Yeah, a lot of the trans moral panic, especially the stuff surrounding kids, is really hurting trans kids and their ability to access transition care. And we see this as well in Montreal even. Like I believe this time last year, a clinic lost their only HRT, so hormone replacement therapy, providing doctor. And they had four doctors that were coming into the clinic, and none of them were willing to provide this service to the patients. And the issue stated was primarily that they were concerned basically about, usually they would say something along the lines of, we're worried that we will be held liable, that somebody will pursue us. We're worried about our ability to understand this care correctly. The social pressure surrounding this issue has made it much harder. Doctors are generally much more hesitant to provide care to trans minors, even trans minors who would be receiving the same care as somebody who's 18 years old. Even at the McGill Clinic, we've had really issues with patients who are like 17, almost 18, like usually December babies into their first year, who will not be allowed to begin their transitions until they turn 18. It's a big issue, and even for things like advocating for better coverage, this is a time where like organizers like us, we want to see Quebec expand its coverage. We want to see FFS covered. We want to see body contouring covered. We want to see laser hair removal covered by the province. And advocating for these things is really hard when we have to spend all of our time worried about all these attacks on our rights that are happening in this province.
Yeah, so, you know, it's affecting trans people's access to gender-affirming care on the whole, you're saying, not just minors, but more broadly.
Yeah, more broadly, but it's definitely attacking minors the most.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you'd like to learn more about the Trans Patient Union and the services they offer, they're holding a workshop, How to Survive Menstrual Healthcare as a Trans Patient, this coming Monday at 6 p.m. at Ecole 3559 Rue University. You can find more info on their Instagram page. Jacob, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Tu t'es occupé de ton ami qui saignait du nez après qu'il soit rentré dans une porte patio fermée, sans rire de lui?
Évidemment.
Avec ton empathie, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière en santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Hydro-Québec cherche du monde pour travailler cet été comme guide dans ses centrales et centres d'interprétation partout au Québec. Du monde qui a envie de faire partie d'une équipe énergique qui contribue à changer le monde. Du monde qui souhaite vivre une expérience inoubliable qui ouvre des portes. Tu aimes t'exprimer en public et tu cherches un emploi bien rémunéré? Joins-toi à l'équipe. Postule d'ici le 3 mars au hydroquebec.com/emploi-guide.
All right, you are back and listening to Off the Hour, Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM and online at ckut.ca. Last week, a shocking decision from McGill will leave first years in rookie hands. On Thursday, the university told the Association of McGill University Support Employees, also known as AMUSE, that it was getting rid of floor fellows. Floor fellows are McGill's version of residence advisors. They live in residence halls, offer workshops, and one-on-one support to the thousands of students who choose to live in dorms. McGill says it chose not to hire floor fellows back following an internal review. Instead, they'll be increasing the number of residence life facilitator positions, which do not require students to live on campus. Joining me to discuss the layoffs is Graham Scott, Vice President of Floor Fellows at AMUSE. Graham, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you walk me through just pretty quickly, like, what happened on Thursday? How did you and these workers find out about the layoffs?
Well, it came as a huge surprise. So on Thursday, we received an email, all 65 of the floor fellows, around 4 o'clock, saying that there was going to be an important update to the floor fellow role happening over Zoom at 6 o'clock. So we tuned into the Zoom meeting. And we were basically told in 8 minutes that our job was being eliminated and that they would not be providing any more further answers at the time.
Whoa, okay. Yeah. So it was all just like, you know, you're going to be continuing for what, a month and a half more and then nothing else.
Mm-hmm. So the floor fellow contract runs concurrent to the academic year when we have, you know, first years living in residence, as that's, you know, we're there to support them. So basically the contract will expire in the first week of April. And then from there, that will be, according to McGill, the end of floor fellows.
And did that come as a shock to you?
It came as a huge shock for us. You know, floor fellows are one of the fundamental pillars of the McGill student experience. And we have been for 30 years, going back to the 1990s. You know, this is a really old and really storied institution, and the impact that floor fellows have, you know, really, really can't be understated. So absolutely, we were really surprised to hear this news.
Yeah, I think, you know, for those who aren't familiar with res life at McGill, why is the floor fellow position so unique? Because I think it is different from other RA positions at universities, but, you know, it's something that is a bit like insider baseball. If you're not a student at McGill, if you haven't lived in residence, you might not know the difference or be able to kind of put your finger on that. But can you tell me more?
Absolutely. So what I can talk you through really quick is a really brief outline of the floor fellow role and what floor fellows do. So really, it's an incredibly broad portfolio of services we provide. So beyond just obviously running events and building community and sort of decorating the hall, our primary responsibilities are to complete check-ins. So every 2 weeks, we need to be checking in on each one of the residents that's under our charge, you know, be that having a conversation with them, seeing them, you know, having a, you know, a virtual, like a text message conversation with them every 2 weeks. So we are keeping tabs on their well-being. Beyond that, we are trained in a really, you know, pretty extensive array of mental health and sort of emergency care resources. So we are trained in receiving disclosures of sexual violence. We are trained in administering naloxone. We are trained in recognizing the signs of overdose. We are trained in recognizing the signs of intoxication and what to do in those scenarios. You know, we're trained in how to recognize self-harm, managing suicidality, how to approach those issues in a community-based context. We're all CPR first aid certified. So, you know, beyond just being this, you know, this community support role, we really do a lot of the time perform really on the ground, flexible first responder work in these residences.
Yeah. And, you know, for those who haven't gone to university anywhere else, I'm coming with two other undergrad experiences under my belt, but I can tell you that from my experience, like other kind of RA positions, you know, they don't do half of what floor fellows do at McGill. And a big difference that I've heard people talk about is just when folks come to McGill, they're often 18, they're legal here, and there's a culture of kind of, you know, drinking and partying that floor fellows are there to make sure happens safely so that nobody gets hurt, in a way where, you know, at other universities, much of the approach is based around abstinence, and that floor fellows often offer other kinds of supports, whether that's around like even just feeling okay as a racialized student or gender and sexuality things, that, that there's kind of a more fulsome role there. Is that fair to say? And I guess how does that square with this new position that McGill is looking to increase, this RLF position, Residence Life Facilitator?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned, you know, dealing with issues of, you know, racialized students, supporting people in these different positions. And so, you know, obviously, yes, we are trained pretty extensively in EDI. So that is also something that's under our purview, like you mentioned. In terms of, you know, what makes floor fellows different from a res advisor position at, you know, other universities, is that floor fellows are primarily not a disciplinary role. So our job is not to go around performing room checks or inspections. Our job is not to be the cops in res. Our job is to be peer support. And actually, when you, we go back to 2014, which was when floor fellows first unionized, a key reason that we did unionize was because the floor fellows at the time sensed that McGill was moving away from harm reduction and toward a more abstinence-based, sort of prevention-based approach in residence. And floor fellows, you know, as the staff who actually live in those residences, support those first years day-to-day, we knew very well that moving away from a harm reductive approach was going to have real tangible negative consequences.
So, is that what, yeah, is that what you're seeing now with the switch to the Residence Life Facilitator positions? Is there anything else the university has done in recent years since floor fellows have unionized to kind of push this even further?
Well, I mean, it's a twofold question. So when we talk about the Residence Life Facilitator position, it really needs to be stressed how much this is not a replacement for floor fellows. So as a Residence Life Facilitator, you know, you look at the job description that's up on the McGill website, their only purview is events. So the only thing that the Residence Life Facilitator team organizes is, you know, outings, community events, Halloween pumpkin carving, stuff like that. Which obviously I don't want to denigrate that. That's, you know, that's a really crucial service, but it doesn't even begin to compare to the vast amount of services and support that Floor Fellows offer. And I think it really needs to be stressed that Floor Fellows are live-in staff. So we are down the hall. We are a text message or a knock away pretty much at all times, when there's an emergency, when someone just needs to talk, when someone needs advice, when someone needs help navigating McGill bureaucracy, when someone needs help navigating, you know, the Quebec government or the Canadian government. And I think it really needs to be brought home that, you know, we can talk about these other services that McGill has brought up in when they're citing, you know, they've cited in this decision. So they've talked about the Wellness Hub, the local wellness advisors, OSFERS, formerly SACOMS, the Office of the Dean of Students. And what really differentiates Floor Fellows from all of those services is that Floor Fellows live there. So we have our finger on the pulse of these residents' well-being all the time. And in order to access support from a Floor Fellow as a first year, you don't need to book online. You know, you don't need to go through with entering your email and doing the two-step authentication. And
yeah, you just send a text.
Yeah, you just send a text. You just knock on the door. You know, you don't need to book a virtual appointment for 2 weeks away. So I think that with the elimination of Floor Fellows, this really crucial suite of services, flexible, on-the-ground, personalized, intimate support that we provide is going to be lost.
Yeah, and why do you think that McGill then is laying Floor Fellows off? You know, they say they conducted an internal review and the decision was made, and I quote, to better align with the growing and changing needs of students and the evolving demographic of our student resident population, end quote. And they've said also that the RLFs are also supporting upper year and grad students and residents. So maybe that's a reference to that. It's not clear, you know. What does that sort of mean to you, and what are the other factors that might be at play here?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it has to be noted that McGill has not shared any of those, the results of this internal review with us. We have not seen those. And what I also have to say is that, you know, there was no open consultation. So there was no open discussion about the role that Floor Fellows play. There was no consultation with the McGill community, with the residents, with the Floor Fellows, and especially with any of the other myriad of, you know, McGill services that we work alongside. So in residences specifically, we work very closely with the protection patrollers. We work very closely with the porters. But beyond that, as Floor Fellows, we all have, you know, an individual professional relationship with the local wellness advisors who work in residence. We're able to offer first years those referrals. Part of Floor Fellow training is what's called the Services Roundtable, where all of the McGill services, so the Wellness Hub, Financial Aid, First People's House, you know, the Black Students Network, all of these sort of networks and student offices will come by and explain to the Floor Fellows, here's what we do, here's how you can get in touch with us. So, you know, it's, I think it's really hard to look at that and conclude that Floor Fellows have become outmoded because there's these other services. I think that sometimes, you know, as a resident in these buildings, it's really difficult to understand exactly what Floor Fellows do. And the example that really brought this home to me was when I was in my first year living in Solihull. And my Floor Fellow, you know, had a really tremendous impact on me, even though I didn't actually really know her very well, and I had no idea what she was doing. You know, I think I actually skipped my hall meeting in first year. I was that kind of person, you know, I turned out okay. But my Floor Fellow was there for me two or three times throughout the year when I needed someone to talk to, or I just needed to know someone cared about me. And that made such a tremendous difference to my experience in that first year where I was living alone in that really transitional period. And then the funny thing was, in the coming years, when I actually became her colleague, I got an insight into all of the crazy stuff that she had been dealing with on my floor while I was living there. Really serious stuff, stuff like eating disorders, you know, serious mental health concerns, conflict resolution. So there was a lot of really serious stuff that was going on behind the scenes that I didn't see. And it's really important to remember that, you know, like all people who work in the mental health community support sphere, we're actually bound by really strict requirements for confidentiality. So a lot of the time, when we're doing our job, and especially if we're doing our job well, that means that you don't actually see a lot of what we're doing.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, in AI, they talk about the doorman fallacy, which is basically like you automate the job of a doorman and you think, okay, it's somebody who opens the doors, maybe adds a little bit of security. We can do this with a computer with artificial intelligence, but what you don't think about is all the other ways in which, you know, they're keeping an eye on things, they're seeing what needs to be fixed, who's coming and going, they're there for people to come and chat with and find resources about the building, you know, and the kind of thinking in that is, well, you can sometimes lose more money than you gain by getting rid of these key roles, especially if you don't understand everything about how they work. Mm-hmm. And I guess that brings me to the big financial pressure, right, that McGill is under right now because of the out-of-province tuition hikes. Although they haven't said this is the reason they're cutting the floor fellow position, you know, it's worth asking whether it's related. Floor fellows are paid at McGill, they're unionized. But, you know, am I right in thinking that the residence life facilitators are also paid and unionized? I'm wondering then, is there any kind of financial incentive for the university to switch from around 65 floor fellows to, I guess, fewer RLFs, around 45? But apart from the number, you know, is there kind of a financial motive here, or is it just these other things that we've been talking about?
Yeah, well, it's hard to speculate. Obviously, we haven't, you know, McGill has not made us privy to their books, so we can't look behind the scenes and know what they're thinking. I mean, what I can say on that is that financial pressure on the university absolutely does not eliminate any of the needs or this crucial role that floor fellows fill. And in fact, when we look at actually how the floor fellow position is compensated, I think that I would argue, and a lot of people would argue, that floor fellows you know, generate a lot of tangible and intangible value for the university. So floor fellows are actually giving McGill a really tremendous bang for their buck. So, you know, aside from being paid only for 13 hours a week, despite this being basically a full-time live-in position, we're compensated primarily through receiving subsidized housing. So it's important to clarify, we don't receive free housing. We actually pay for our housing. We are charged the maximum that an employer can charge an employee for employer-provided housing given in the Act Respecting Labor Standards. And part of the reason that we, well, the reason that actually we receive subsidized housing is because being a live-in resource and being there and being accessible is a key part of our job. So when you're working, you know, a more conventional 9-to-5 job, you know, your employer is supplying you with like a desk and a work computer and an office. Those are not considered kind of perks or like free things that the employer is giving you. Those are just basic tools to do the job. And having a room and in this residence and being part of the community, that is just a key part of this job. So, you know, on the broad spectrum, when we look at, you know, McGill has this team of highly dedicated, highly trained, highly flexible and easy to mobilize staff that are doing, you know, a huge variety of roles in the residences. And we're primarily compensated through room and board. And you compare that to, you know, hiring 45 new staff who, you know, despite actually being paid for a similar number of hours, you know, RLFs are going to be paid for between 10 and 20 hours a week. They're being paid basically the same amount of wages, but they're performing a way smaller, list of roles and list of services, and they're way less available. I think that, you know, purely from, you know, a financial perspective of how can we generate the most value, you know, tangible and intangible for our residents, how can we enrich these lives the most, how can we be looking out for them the most, I think that floor fellows are, you know, a really cost-effective solution for the university. You know, there's a reason that almost all major universities in North America with an extensive residence system have live-in support staff.
Yeah.
It's because it works.
It's interesting, especially because, you know, Principal Deepsaney has said that applications to McGill are down by 20% this year. So it is a kind of, it's an interesting time to try and be innovating and trying something new in residence. And we'll have to see, obviously, how it goes. But just to wrap up, what are the next steps for the union? Is there any recourse that you as casual workers have in the wake of this? It's not so much, I guess, a layoff as just the university saying, we're not going to hire you back. So is there anything that the union can or is thinking about doing here?
Mm-hmm. So we're looking into it, a bunch of different directions right now. I'm very happy to say that the Public Service Alliance of Canada, of which we are a component, has mobilized really spectacularly to help us. And we're looking into all the options available. But I think that, beyond just kind of the legal and, union side of this discussion, we've received hundreds of pieces of individual testimony that have come pouring in from McGill residents and parents and community members going back to the 1990s, personally attesting to the value of floor fellows. Testimony saying, my floor fellow saved my life. I watched my floor fellow save my friends' lives. I was there when I saw my floor fellow, stop me from dropping out. And we've received hundreds of pieces of testimony to that effect. We've had people who worked at McGill 10 years ago, in the mental health sphere, in the resident sphere, reach out to us asking what they can do to help overturn this decision. We've had, people in other departments at McGill who work alongside the floor fellows who are really concerned about this decision. So I think all things considered, what we want to be focusing on right now is leveraging this vast, influx of support that we've received in order to generate dialogue with McGill so that we can find a middle ground that preserves, what we consider to be the really essential and indelible role that floor fellows provide that just can't be replaced by staff who are not live-in.
All right. Well, we will be watching that as it progresses. Thank you so much, Graham, for coming on.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
All right. That was Graham Scott, Vice President of Floor Fellows at Amuse. We'll be right back after a short break.
Thank you.
All right. You are listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules, and this is the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup. We're having a pretty McGill-focused episode today. And right now, I am joined by two folks who are on a hunger strike at McGill currently in protest of the university's basically refusal to implement a BDS policy, a Palestinian solidarity policy, in response to the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Can I just get the two of you to introduce yourself?
Hi, you can call me Rox, and that's that.
Yes, hi. For the purpose of this interview, I'll be going by Emma. We're both students at McGill.
Yeah, can you tell me, just, you know, in broad strokes, what is this hunger strike? What are you in strike over? You know, what's going on this week?
Well, it's going to go on for as long as the demands aren't met, and the demands are maybe for to some not simple, but for us it is pretty simple. We want a full divestment, and we want an academic boycott to be put in place, and we want McGill to honor those demands, and so we are on hunger strike until those demands are met.
We have indefinite hunger strikers, so people who are not stopping until the demands are met. But we also have relay hunger strikers for students who want to do just a few days at a time and to get as much support as possible. And of course, we have a bunch of students helping us. We have a care team, outreach team.
Yeah. And in terms of the hunger strike itself, are you guys both on indefinite or are you on the relay strike?
Me personally, I'm an indefinite striker, so I haven't been eating since before midnight on February the 19th. So I haven't been eating for, I don't know, close to 48 hours now.
I am currently doing care work and managing a bit with the socials, and I'm hoping to go on an indefinite hunger strike soon enough myself as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I know that, you know, you're drinking water and broth as well to, you know, make sure that you don't collapse. But this is a really huge decision and a huge step. I'm wondering if you both can tell me about, you know, how it got to this point where the McGill administration has been so resistant to boycott and divestment efforts that, you know, you felt that this was the step to take.
Well, basically, there's been protests on campus for years now. There's been efforts for years now to raise awareness about the apartheid in Palestine and occupied Palestine, with the genocide that started, that we should say intensified on October 7th. These efforts were ramped up. There was a referendum passed where 78% of undergraduate students voted for a policy against genocide, which included asking our administration to fully divest and to academically boycott Israeli apartheid, just like we did with South Africa back in 1986. And just now in February, graduates also overwhelmingly voted at the PGSS for a similar policy, again, asking for administration to meet these demands. And so it's reached a point where students have clearly asked for it, or there's been protests on campus. There's been all sorts of groups on campus that have showed support and solidarity, but our administration ignores us. And given the urgency of the situation, given that children are without food, water, humanitarian aid, electricity, right now, all throughout Gaza, given that there's about 10,000 Palestinians that are currently held hostage in a military court, given that this apartheid has been going on for many decades now, we felt that it was an appropriate action to take to put our bodies on the line and to do so in solidarity with this genocide with the Palestinians undergoing the genocide right now, in order to get results as soon as possible from our administration.
Yeah, and I know that you have a statement, right, from a Palestinian student who is involved in your campaign that you were looking to share. You know, maybe now is a time to make that heard as well.
Yes, okay. So we have a statement from this student. As a Palestinian McGill student with family in Gaza, I have been having an extremely difficult time with my studies. On my way to a midterm exam in the fall, I received a phone call from my mother telling me that my cousin and his two young daughters, ages 7 and 5, were killed in an airstrike in Khan Yunis. Needless to say, I performed poorly on the exam. This was not helped by the countless emails by the McGill administration, both supporting Israel's occupation and demonizing Palestinian advocacy on campus. I no longer felt safe on campus. McGill's $20 million investments in the Israeli occupation and the genocide of my family and people. It is not ethical to continue paying tuition at McGill. Like any student, I just want to get an education. I also don't want my education to be funding a genocide, especially when it is a genocide that has killed over 25 members of my family, all within the safe zones of Gaza, safe zones in quotation. I am participating in the hunger strike because we have exhausted all our options when it comes to demanding the McGill administration to stop their funding and support of a genocidal occupation. We as students will be heard and will be taken seriously. My family in Gaza have not eaten in 4 months. They are starving. McGill is paying. It is time for us to starve in solidarity. It feels wrong for us to eat while Palestinians are starving. And McGill is investing $20 million annually to keep them hungry.
Yeah, I mean, wow, that's a lot to hear and take in. But what jumps out at me, I mean, among the many things in that statement is this $20 million figure, right? And this is what BDS is all about, is boycott institutions who have ties to Israel, especially academic institutions, academics coming on conferences or things like that. D is for divest, right? These investments in Israeli companies or companies that are, operating in illegal settlements, and then sanctions, which is sort of outside of what McGill can do, though, you know, if it took a strong stance, obviously that could count as a sanction. Can you tell me more about the kinds of ties, you know, those $20 million, those academic exchanges that are the exact thing that is prompting you to go on this hunger strike?
Yes. Some of this has already been outlined previously. We're not the ones who came up with these this list of companies. For example, McGill invests $515,000 in Lockheed Martin, a weapons manufacturer, in Airbus Aerospace, Thales SA, $1.5 million and $1.6 million respectively. These are all weapon manufacturing companies. There are others such as RBC, which has itself shares in mass surveillance system that provides AI tools to the Israeli military. So all these different companies, whether directly or indirectly, are supporting the current apartheid and the current genocide of Palestinians. We also, on our list, have these four universities: Ben-Gurion University, Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Technion Israel Institute of Technology, and Tel Aviv University. So to different extents, these universities either heavily invest in research and development for the Israeli military, or they've themselves participated in occupying land by literally building their universities upon Palestinian land that's not supposed to be within Israel. So, these are some of the academic ties. And one more I would mention is that we have these two classes in Organic Bio and Digital Faculty of Management. It's kind of the same class, but combined. It's the Comparing Startup Ecosystems. And in the Faculty of Engineering, Building a Winning Business Plan, so FAC 501, Org 434, and Finance 434. These are all companies that basically contribute to what's called tech washing, where technology is considered as this neutral force of progress, when in reality, this technology is being developed to further the oppression of Palestinians. So these are sort of some of the ties that we would like to for our university to cut.
Yeah, and yeah. The line has sort of been that they just want a safe and respectful discourse on campus. This kind of like neutrality, right, from the administration. And that's why they're saying, you know, they can't do any kind of BDS, although they recently divested from the top 200, like, carbon emission fossil fuel companies. So there is a kind of divestment that's possible on campus. You know, in light of what you've just said, what would your response be to that kind of argument?
I would say that there's not really such a thing as neutrality in these types of things, right? We can't, saying nothing is quite literally, like if you were on the street and you were watching somebody get stabbed, right? If you stood there and did nothing, you would not be neutral. You would be complicit. How is this any different? How have we allowed ourselves to be removed so much from people and from the world that we are, you know? And it's not neutral, right? Because neutral would be not being involved at all. But there is involvement. There's a financial involvement. There's normalization ties with academic involvement. So even that neutrality is a mirage. It's an illusion. It's not really neutral.
And I'd like to also add that you mentioned the fossil fuels example, the big win that we had, $50 million just last semester. There's also the example of 1986, when we got McGill to divest from South African apartheid, and it was $50 million at the time, which adjusted to inflation today is about $140 million. So in fact, this was a much larger number. And so we think that $20 million is possible. And not only that, it's a not only is it possible, it's a question of when and not if it's going to happen, and we want to make it happen now.
Yeah, and, you know, I hear that, and especially the South African divestment that happened, as far as I know, pretty quickly from when the campaign was started. But this has been a long time that the administration has been refusing to even hear questions of BDS. You know, they have threatened to withdraw money from the student society, you know, for basically if they ratify votes in favor of BDS on that level. Even fossil fuel divestment, like it took over a decade since the campaign was started for McGill's Board of Governors to actually agree to divest. So, you know, it looks like an uphill battle. Just on the level of your campaign, I'm curious about, you know, how many people are involved, and if you can tell me more about, you know, what you have in place to keep each other safe during this.
So right now we have a dozen people, I would say, who are actively involved and heavily involved, right? We also have other people who are joining us, and we're very happy to have the support pouring in. And there's a lot of things that we are doing to keep people safe and secure, just in terms of, like, health for, say, the indefinite hunger strikers. We're heavily recommending that people, you know, get medical checks and make sure they have support, which is why some people are starting a bit later. We ask also that they fill a form where they acknowledge the risks and they understand what they are taking on, the responsibility that they are taking on. We also make sure to have a care team, as we talked about earlier, I believe, with the so the care team is there to support the people who are hunger striking on campus as they go around to keep them safe from harassment, from violence, and also just in case they faint. And for any reasons, we try to keep a support system and a network. And, you know, we are independent students. We are functioning on our own, but we do try to build a sort of community where people can rely on each other and help each other.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the threat of harassment and violence. Have you guys faced harassment? I know you've been outside the James Administration Building and in Red Path Library. You know, especially the latter location, there's a lot of through traffic there. What is the response that you've been getting from the on-campus community?
In general, I think we've gotten a lot of positive feedback, overwhelmingly positive feedback. But there have been some exceptions from the work that we started doing. Online, we got a couple creepier messages. For example, when we started hunger strike, people asking, will there be food at the event? We got literally spat on yesterday, or during our first sit-in in front of the administration building.
And today as well.
Oh.
This happened 2 days in a row. We don't know if it's the same person, really. This has happened twice. They go by really quickly and just spit on us and go. Sorry.
But no, that's, I mean, that's like kind of hard to imagine, but it's like good to talk about, because I think people would, most people wouldn't probably believe that anyone would treat anybody else like that, even, you know, despite this difference in opinion. But I guess, you know, you say it's been overwhelmingly positive. I've heard that you have also heard from McGill administration. What has that response been like?
Essentially, we sent them an email telling them that students have been asking for this and we are going on hunger strike, informing them of our hunger strike. And immediately, almost immediately the next day, so yesterday we got a response from them telling us that, well, you know, we have a right to express ourselves. We should worry about our safety, but they'd like to meet, come sit down and meet with us. And we've sort of come to the conclusion, and this hasn't been announced yet, but we don't think that we would like to meet them behind closed doors under any circumstances. We think that if there's a meeting, it should be a public meeting, that all the pro-Palestine groups on campus or even all students should be invited, because this is a public concern, because a majority of students have already voted in support of a policy, a divest and boycott policy. So we're just part of that movement, and we would like for all students to be there if there's any meetings at all. We would like for all them to be public. And also just because any closed door conversation that might happen will inevitably benefit the authority, right? That's always how it works. It weakens democratic movements. Any closed-door negotiations, back-door negotiations, weaken democratic movements and benefit those in authority, giving them an upper hand. So we will not meet with them unless it's a public meeting open to all.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, because definitely the administration, as you said, there is a benefit for them in being able to meet behind closed doors, because no matter how that meeting goes, they can say, well, we reached out, we gave the olive branch, and if you refuse their terms, then it gets pushed back onto you. So we'll have to see whether the university agrees to a public meeting or how long that takes. But, you know, if you don't hear back from them, I guess, what are the next steps? Do you have a plan in place to kind of, you know, up the ante so that this becomes an issue that McGill just can't ignore?
Well, we're going to be increasing in number, hopefully. We're going to be increasing our presence on campus as time goes along. Obviously, our deteriorating health in itself is going to be a pressure on McGill. But also, we are calling for a larger strike on university, a general strike. We have a pledge form that's up on our Linktree. And this is something that we do not necessarily want to lead. We want to do it in cooperation with other groups on campus. But people can already start filling that out to show their interest. And we think that that if that were to happen, this would be the most direct way to get McGill to listen to our demands. Just simply students not showing up to class and doing so all the way until the end of the semester, not, you know, one or a few days at a time, but indefinitely as well. So general strikes are, if it is possible, it would be the strongest tool in our arsenal as students, as a community, I think.
Yeah, so you mentioned that folks can sign up to strike. What are other ways that people on campus or in Montreal more broadly can support you? Because obviously this is like something that will take not just a physical toll, but also takes an enormous amount of like just mental strength. And like, you know, as you said, people are supporting you, but people are also like spitting on you, harassing you. What are ways that people who, you know, support this campaign can show up for the hunger strikers at McGill?
I mean, the main thing, like, we have a link tree that is available with like forms and such things. We mentioned about that. Also just, you know, sharing, reposting and bringing attention to it, and, you know, putting pressure on McGill to divest, to listen to the students, right? This is going to be a fight for us, but if people who are not ex-students, parents that are concerned, if all these people start showing up and, you know, and putting pressure in their own ways by, you know, making it, making their opinions, their dissent with McGill's decisions so far publicly known, then there will be more pressure. Obviously, this is really a pressure game, right? We cannot make them do anything. We just hope that we have enough people pressuring them to so that they end up following through with these demands.
Yeah. Well, you know, only time will tell. And as you guys push for a public meeting with McGill administration, I'm sure this is something that everyone on campus and in the community will be following along, and probably a good opportunity for the wider campus community to push hard for that as well. But thank you so much. Thank you both for coming on CQUT, for talking about this work. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. That was the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT. I've been your host, Jules Bugel. Thanks so much for listening. And as always, you can find all of these clips online at ckut.ca.